report is now set, please be seated.
Morning, council. Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here in the appeal of my client, Sharon Spencer, who was convicted in the Superior Court of two counts of assault, two counts of possession of a firearm during commission of a felony, and one count of possession of a deadly weapon by a person prohibited. The first thing I'd like to point out is that I believe the state and the defense are essentially in agreement as to two aspects of this appeal. One is the standard and scope of review, and that is de novo, and we are also essentially in agreement, I believe, that there are really no facts in dispute in this case. We're arguing the same facts. And what that means is because it's de novo review is that there's not a deferential standard applied to these. It's ruling below based upon the facts. The court may look at it freshly. And I believe that based upon those facts, the legal principles which are applicable compel a favorable view for the defense. And that is because the court has considered this issue of multiplicity a number of times in the past few years, and the most recent consideration of it in a significant case was the Washington case about a year ago. And in the Washington case was a robbery as opposed to an assault, just like this case. But it involved charging for multiple offenses. And we believe that the key language in Washington, which is also applicable to this case, is that, Washington, quote, engaged in separate distinct acts and formed separate intents to commit each crime, end quote. Now, why that is important is because it illustrates the fundamental principle of criminal law. It essentially encapsulates there the definition of a criminal offense. A criminal offense is not merely an act. A criminal offense is both an act and an intent. It's an act and a mens rea. In this case, essentially there's no dispute in the sense that there were two acts, in the sense that there were two pullings of the trigger. However, under the definition of an offense, and under the principle that the court applied in Washington, there were two separate intents in Washington, whereas we contend this morning that there was only one intent in this case, and that's why this case is distinguishable from Washington based upon the principles applied in Washington.
Counsel, let me just interrupt you here. Aren't we really, and isn't the inquiry whether there was sufficient evidence that a jury could find that there were two intents, two separate intents? And doesn't your position have to be, the answer to the first question is yes, that there is no evidence, and therefore no jury question on this point, that is, it was error to even submit the issue to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes. How, if that is the inquiry, then how do we agree with your position as a matter of law when in this case the victim turned around and even though there was only a short period of time between the two shots, there at least was enough that if there was a separate intent, it could have been formed?
Well, that scenario emphasizes that, not that scenario posits that there was a separation in time of a very short period of time, but it also posits that there was essentially the same intent, which in our view is consistent with one offense having been committed.
It doesn't posit one intent or two intents. That's the issue we have to decide.
Yes, if it is one intent, therefore it is one offense.
But the jury, or any fact finder, have to infer whether or not there were separate intents from the circumstances. Correct?
Correct.
And in these circumstances, what is it about these what is it about these circumstances that would preclude any fact finder from concluding that there was other than one intent?
There are not separate intents. The same intent serves as evidence to prove both offenses under this record. That is why, since the convictions were multiplicitous, it is the same intent. There's one other, I think in Washington, there is key language.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
Because I want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly. Are you saying that because the two shots were very close in time, that's what establishes that there was only one intent?
Not in and of itself, Your Honor. That they were close in time is supportive of their being just one intent, but it's not dispositive.
Okay, well, what is?
I'd like to put out this language in Washington. And the court observed that in Washington, Washington changed his mind and formed a second intent. In that robbery case, he was letting the victim just walk away. The victim started walking away, about 20 seconds passed. The perpetrator, Washington, changed his mind.
But isn't Washington a pretty unusual set of facts in terms of a person kind of telling the people, go, get out of here, and then, you know, doing something inconsistent with having let them go? Wouldn't you more normally run into a situation like this case where something happens and, you know, there's a proximity of time, but there's no real external evidence of whether the perpetrator had one intent or two intents or three intents, because the perpetrator didn't actually do anything inconsistent as they did in Washington?
Well, in Washington is an unusual set of facts, and that's why it's distinguishable from this case. For instance, in Washington, had he said, give me your wall, give me your chain around your neck, and there hadn't been that 20-second interval, says, where he walked away, was 60-some feet away, and then attacked by the dog, and then the perpetrator says, wait a second, I want your, I forget what item of property it was, but I want your such-and-such, too, while you know, compelling him by force, or says, by weapon, to deliver that property. So in that sense, it's unusual, and the reason why it's unusual is because it makes it that much more distinguishable from this case.
Right, but if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is because we don't have an obvious, what I would call an obvious circumstance like in Washington where there seemed to be a change of mind and then a subsequent act, and so we can say, yes, there were two intents here. Since we don't have that, we have to conclude that there was only one? I mean, is that basically what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that at all. And the court can distinguish that type of circumstance, but this case is even stronger than that situation. Because in this case, the ruling below was that, you know, distinguishing, you know, the separation of time, the court found, the factors that the court found below militated towards one offense. There were very small, there was a temporal, the temporal separation was very small. Of course, the spatial separation was minute. But the court relied upon, Superior Court relied upon separate injuries as the distinction. Not separate intent, not interruptions, not distinct intents. The court relied upon separate injuries.
Well, let's assume the court inappropriately relied on separate injuries. What difference does that make to us?
It makes a difference because the reliance on separate injuries is not a criteria upon which the distinction between one or multiple offenses should be drawn.
But if the record reflects that there was sufficient evidence to take the issue of separate intents to the jury. And as I understand it, it was presented to the jury on the platform of two separate indictments, each for second-degree assault. So the jury would be asked to address whether there were two separate intents for two separate offenses, and you would be able to argue to them the facts don't support that. What's the problem if the jury could make that factual decision? It was appropriate to get it to them, whatever the court's rationale for getting it to them might have been, and they had the distinction made in two separate indictments, and you had the opportunity to either ask for a specific instruction for them to consider it or could argue to them that there weren't two separate intents. What's the harm?
The harm in that is that that's the issue that exists in every multiplicity case. That in Shields, says the arson case, you know, from Sussex County, in the recent drug case from Sussex County, the jury had the opportunity to decide that there were two separate intents based upon the indictment and the jury instructions. Still, the multiple offenses were multiplicities in both of those cases and improper. So simply because the jury gets to consider the question and convict the defendant of different offenses doesn't answer the underlying question. Otherwise, the
multiple circumstances are, as I posited in my thought, that there are facts to support either a conclusion that there were two separate intents or that there was only one.
No, we don't believe that there are facts to support that there are two separate intents here. In fact, the court discounted the element of intent in its ruling.
Suppose the court, in its ruling, found two separate intents. Let's dispose of that variable for a moment, so we can focus on the issue, which is whether there's enough evidence to support such a finding that the court made. Are you arguing that there's not even a possibility on these facts that there was a change of mind or a change of intent?
No.
Or are you arguing that, there's a possibility, but the evidence has got to be stronger than it is here?
The latter, Your Honor. The court didn't find, the evidence doesn't support, on the record, doesn't support two separate intents. And the court properly, therefore, discounted it as a factor.
Does it mean the court specifically found that there were not two separate intents?
The court discounted that as...
What do you mean by that, Mr. Jones?
What do I mean by that?
It was argued to her and she ruled it out of the case?
I thought that she focused on the fact that there were two separate wounds.
Yes.
Wounds, two injuries.
Yes. That was the distinguishing factor. On page... The exhibits as to the brief on page 73 of the court's ruling. It is the court's findings that third paragraph down, line 17. So one of the questions before the court is whether there is a temporal separation, and another question is whether separate intents were created. The court finds that there is very minimal temporal separation here. Obviously, there is a second separation at most. So the next issue is whether or not the court can do as the Supreme Court did in Washington and discount that temporal separation. So this analysis is going to focus on whether separate intents were created. And there is also one other piece of analysis I'm going through. The court does find that an intent can be formed in an instant. An intent can be formed in an instance is, it begs the question. Yes, as an abstract principle, an intent can be formed in an instant. The question is, however, whether there were two separate intents that suffice to establish two offenses for the two acts.
Well, it's inferable from that statement, that is, that an intent can be formed in an instant, that the trial court was finding that there was a separate intent.
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. Based upon that wording and the court's findings, the court expressed the principle correct. An intent can be formed in an instant.
The court found there wasn't a separate intent.
The court didn't address it. The principle the court applied was applicable to...
Right. The court didn't address it.
The court did not address it.
And the circumstances before us are ambiguous. That is, you could draw either inference. But your argument is that now that it's a legal matter, we can only draw one inference because the evidence to support the opposite inference is not sufficient.
Well, why is it such a great leap to go from you can form intent in an instant, and here the defendant fired two shots, and there were two injuries, one each per shot. Why is it a great leap to say he intended to shoot a second time and to inflict the second injury?
Well, under those, why? Because there are not two separate intents. An intent could be formed, had this been one shot, one wound, and it was almost spontaneous, and in the heat of passion, in 1 second, the defendant develops as the intent just to shoot. Whether it is assault, whether it's murder, that principle is correct. An intent can be formed in an instant. If it was murder, the intent can be formed. That is distinguishable from the instance where we apply that rule to say that if the defendant was shot, if the defendant shot 9 times at a fleeing says victim and missed, under this rationale, that's 9 counts of attempted murder.
Well, would it really be that, because all of the shots would be part of the necessary proof to have an overall intent to kill as opposed to separate intents to injure?
Well, that's what this case is. It's an overall intent to injure, is the defendant.
Well, is it theoretically impossible that there was a mind change when the fleeing began? Shot you in the knee, if you're going to flee, now I have to bring you down by shooting higher.
Theoretically, that's possible, because on different evidence. If this case had been, the facts in this case have been such that the defendant shot the victim, walked away, the victim said, hey, you're still a chump, or yelled something to him or said something to him, I'm still going to the police, something to aggravate the defendant again. The defendant turned around, went back, and shot again and injured him. That's your Washington case. That's two separate intents. That's a change of mind.
There's evidence of provocation and circumstances where there could not have been a second injury without a change of mind.
Correct.
But this is not a case where the perpetrator is holding his hand on a trigger, his finger on a trigger of an automatic weapon, so that all of the injuries are taking place within the same second. This is a case where there was one shot to one part of the body, the victim turns around, and then there's a second shot to a different part of the body.
Well, still, under those circumstances, any time there are multiple shots, multiple injuries, there are multiple offenses without any evidence of a separate intent or a change of mind under that scenario.
You use in your brief the analogy to the basic fisticuff fight where somebody strikes somebody in the jaw once and in the same period of short time and space strikes them again and again and again. Does it make any difference if you hit somebody once or twice and then that somebody turns and tries to walk away from you to avoid being hit again and then you strike him again? Is that multiplicity or is that two separate incidents separated by time and space, each with its intent to injure?
What I can say is that it may be a closer says question, but in that instance, other states have decided, I think it's the Prillo decision from New York, courts generally decide, applying the substantive law, which requires both an act and intent, they generally find one offense under those circumstances. And that's very evident from the cases in North Carolina. In North Carolina, in the Brooks decision, there's several cases in North Carolina which address almost this exact fact situation. And the court in North Carolina overturned convictions where juries had found separate offenses. Nonetheless, the North Carolina courts overturned the convictions as multiplicitous because there was, quote, or they affirmed one conviction in the Brooks case. There was a distinct interruption in the original assault followed by a second assault. And in that case, it's evident there was a distinct, says here, the only interruption here is temporal, and it's no more than 2 or 3 seconds, and there's no evidence of a change of mind or a different state of mind on the part of, or a renewed state of mind on the part of the defendant.
There is a second interruption, isn't there? And that's that the victim turned around because he was trying to escape. It wasn't that he just stood there.
Yeah, the exact, in the dependency suggests, and in the, at least in the state's brief, it suggests, and I quote, Scott turned and began walking away between the times the first and second shots were fired. Is that a distinction without a meaningful difference?
Yes, because it doesn't mean that the defendant had a separate intent. It's a temporal distinction, as opposed to an intent. It focuses solely on time.
But you're assuming your conclusion. You're saying that there's no way that the victim's turning around in that period of time can have any evidentiary force? Why not?
If there were stronger facts, if the defendant did something to show that he had changed his mind, that he had attempted to flee after one shot, he turned around, as it ran, and you know, just ran into a door, whatever, saw the defendant, saw the victim again, saw that the victim was not injured, was not ambulatory, and shot again.
Or suppose the defendant lowered his gun. The victim then turns around and is trying to escape, but in the same period of time, the defendant raises his gun and shoots him a second.
That's a factual case distinguishable. That is a factual distinction which isn't evident from these circumstances, Your Honor. Had this been a situation where the defendant had shot the victim, and the record indicated that the victim would have turned around, started to fall down or whatever, but didn't just fall down, turned around, and the defendant said, oh, you can still stand? Take that. That's a factually distinguishable circumstance, insofar which reflects on the defendant's intent, independently of the temporal separation between the two shots.
So there has to be a verbal expression in order to get to that?
There has to be an indicia. There has to be evidence upon which that inference can be drawn that there was a change in the state of mind of the defendant.
Body language,
possibly. It could serve, but it's not here in this record.
Let's assume that we agree with your position, but there's an additional problem, and that is how does this court express it doctrinally? We're talking about a very narrow issue here. That is the quantum of evidence that's required to draw the inference that's sufficient to put the matter before the jury. How would you formulate that?
Well, the situation could perhaps be improved just through jury instructions, that you give additional instructions to the jury that they have to find separate intents and emphatic instructions.
I'm not talking about how we instruct the jury. We're talking about how we instruct the judge when deciding whether or not to put the issue before the jury.
The court, when making the distinction whether there are separate offenses or one offense, should not focus or primarily focus on the act itself, but intent is an equally important element of the offense, and reliance upon says injury alone, a primary reliance upon injury, you know, is insufficient if there is an adequate evidence of an independent and changed intent for the new offense. I'm not very good at drafting.
Did you want to save your last 2.5 minutes?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. There are no free shots. This is a case of two acts, two crimes. There is no reason why the the defendant in this case, Sharon Spencer, should not have been charged for both of his voluntary acts.
Let me interrupt for a moment. First of all, following up on Justice Jacobs' question, is there any evidence in this record that the defendant lowered the gun, lowered his hand to his side after the first shot and then picked his hand up again to fire the second shot?
No. There's nothing in the record that no witnesses actually saw the or testified to whether an arm went up or down.
Okay. So, and what would happen, what would your position be if instead of the victim after being shot in the leg turning around, if the victim had fallen down to the ground after the first shot and fallen in such a way that he had kind of twisted himself around so that the second shot would hit him where the second shot hit him, would you still be making the argument that that's two crimes?
Yes. I think that if the it had been charged differently, for example, the state could have chosen to, in the scenario you're positing, the state could have charged attempted murder with the idea that the circumstances would show.
Let's not go to something different. I'm talking about two charges, just as the charges that were done here, and the only difference in the facts is that instead of turning around and still being standing, the victim fell down after the first shot and then was fired upon the second time. Would that justify two counts?
There's still enough evidence, I believe, to allow a jury to decide. There's still a time, I'm assuming you're still talking about.
The same?
Still, 4 seconds is a long time in terms of firing a gun. You have to choose to pull that trigger again. One, two, three, four. That's a long time. If the victim were lying on the ground, you clearly, the defendant would have been trying to, or the jury could infer that the defendant wanted to inflict a second wound. The state would certainly think that it would be appropriate to charge more than one. There were two voluntary acts.
Well, then wouldn't it follow from the way you're approaching this that any time a person uses a gun other than an automatic gun, that each shot constitutes a separate crime?
It can. I believe the state would say, would normally, if there was a split second, perhaps that would not be an appropriate charging decision. If there were multiple shots very rapidly, the state would more appropriately charge an attempted murder.
You are focused on the fact that we're not genuinely interested in what the state would charge. What we have to formulate is a rule of law to instruct trial judges what kind of analysis they do when they're deciding to let the issue of two separate offenses go to the jury for a determination. So it's not about what the Attorney General's office should do. It's about what the trial judge should do.
Yes, Your Honor. The court has made it pretty clear that there is a standard out there, and that is separation, be it ever so slight, temporally, spatially, and a separate intent.
You're arguing today that as a matter of law, if you fire a gun 4 seconds apart multiple times, every time you fire the gun, you've committed different offenses?
Potentially, yes.
And why is that? Is it because the length of time separating the two shots is such that the only explanation could be a change of mind or a new decision?
I think there's sufficient evidence based on the time difference and that a jury could infer a separate intent. Each case is clearly going to be very
specific. Let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's suppose that you had a situation where a defendant walks up to a victim and says, give me your money, shoots them. The money isn't surrendered. 4 seconds go by, shoot them again. You've committed two crimes.
That would depend on the crime charged. I understand that that's something you don't want to discuss, but what is charged is relevant to how it gets to the jury.
No, I'm not asking. As a matter of law, what does the trial judge do where in that scenario where you walk up to the victim faces you completely, and you say, give me your money, shoot them. The money's not surrendered. In 4 seconds, shoot them again. Now, what does the judge tell the jury? In face of the argument that although the gun was fired twice, you should only be charged once with robbery and possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony.
The state would argue that there are two crimes, that the victim has been injured twice and a defendant should be liable for that.
Well, no, there are really at least 4 crimes under that theory, because in those 4 seconds you attempted to rob the person twice. Intending to rob him twice in 4 seconds, you also were possessing a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony.
The state would argue that the attempted, the jury would need to be instructed whether to find an attempted robbery and an assault versus 2 attempted robberies to see if there was a separate intent.
Well, we just addressed that in Whitfield. Are you familiar with that decision?
Yes.
But this isn't Whitfield.
No.
In my hypothetical, you've got the victim standing there, shot twice, not surrendering within the 4 seconds. And as I understand your argument, it would be proper to submit that to the jury as 2 attempted robberies and 2 possessions of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony, at least. And you haven't ruled out charging them with assault and maybe attempted murder.
Well, the attempted robbery, it isn't clear to me that there are separate intents on the attempted robbery.
Well, trying to sort out as a court, as Justice Jacobs and the Chief Justice said, as a matter of law, when we have that case, of the 2 shots within 4 seconds in a robbery, and you know we've had many of those, what are we going to be telling trial judges as a matter of law?
That the jury should be instructed that they need to find a separate intent for each act that has been charged as a crime.
Your brief tells us, quoting from our earlier cases, that the defendant's actions must be sufficiently separated in location and time, and the defendant form distinct intents. Then the actions can constitute distinct criminal acts. Have we lost sight of those 3 elements? Separated in location, not just time, separated in location and time, and then sufficient facts to show that there's distinct intents, regardless of what those facts might be. In your multiple firings 4 seconds apart, that doesn't fit neatly into those 3 elements, does it?
The state would suggest that the 4 seconds in terms of firing a gun is a temporal distinction. Spatially, the victim had moved. Perhaps not 3 blocks, but had certainly turned and moved. The injury was complete, the initial injury to the victim. The victim testified, I was shot, I turned and walked away, then he shot me again. That would indicate that there was a change in temporal as well as spatial relationship, and that there was ample time and situation given the turning that all 3 elements of that test are met.
But the 3rd element is, I thought, evidence of a separate intent to shoot a second time. Where's that evidence here? Or do you have to have it?
I believe that can be inferred from the second firing of the weapon.
You agree that some evidence is necessary, that
yes.
It's something beyond the possibility without more that there was a change of intent.
There has to be a basis for a jury to infer
And the basis in this case is the 4-second interval between the two shots?
In conjunction with the movement, yeah.
So these, the first two elements are doing double duty to prove
in a sense, yes. I think they can be used to assist the jury and in the fact finder in a case to infer intent, as in a lot of cases where we have shootings or other events that there's no...
Suppose the facts were the same as they were in this case, except that the interval is now reduced from 4 seconds to 1 second. What's the what outcome?
The state would still contend that intent can be formed in an instant. Whether a jury could infer a different, separate, distinct intent, that's possible.
What you seem to be suggesting is, unless perpetrators of crime are using an automatic weapon, every time they fire a shot, they can be charged with separate offenses.
Potentially. In a one-second interval, I don't think you would also have the victim moving, turning, that fact scenario, which may preclude having someone be able to infer intent. But, for example, in this same scenario, if Spencer had his second shot had missed and hit one of the people getting off the DART bus, there would be no issue about charging two assaults. If he had missed and the shot just went in that direction, there would be no problem in terms of convicting of reckless endangerment and an assault. Each shot was potentially lethal to someone, and there was clearly, in this, given the facts of this case, there was a difference, a temporal, spatial difference that would allow the jury to infer that intent. It's similar to the idea of sexual assault cases, where oftentimes there's been more than one charge of rape or sexual assault with very minimal change in space, in the same location with the same victim.
We addressed that at length in Fetterman several years ago.
And the court noted that simply because there has been one assault doesn't mean that the defendant should be free to engage in a second assault on the same victim. And that this is the same type of thing. You have a victim who's being assaulted multiple times. I would concede that there's a difference in a rage where you might have someone stab someone rapidly in some sort of rage where there would be no sense in finding a separate intent, and there would also be no spatial change in a situation like that. This isn't a case like that. This is a case where there is clearly movement and turning of the victim. There's 4 seconds, which is a long time in terms of deciding to pull a trigger. And there's no reason that the jury should not have been allowed to infer the intent.
Well, you're arguing that there was, in that 4 seconds, there was the opportunity for the defendant not to fire.
Yes, absolutely.
And let me just ask you this. Is there anything in the record that shows whether or not by the expression on his face or otherwise, the defendant was enraged, out of control?
No. There was testimony by the driver of the car, Christopher Price, that there was an argument about money. In this case, we had a reluctant witness, a reluctant victim, so there was the testimony was pulled out begrudgingly, so there was not a lot of detail. But that was the general testimony at trial, was that there was some type of argument.
But there was no evidence that would show the defendant's state of mind, whether he was enraged or somehow.
There was testimony that he got back into the car and said, "Take off," which would certainly allow a jury to infer that he didn't wasn't agitated, he wasn't jumping up and down, he wasn't upset. He simply asked his driver to get him out of there, which would indicate that he was certainly rational about and knew what he had done. So there was nothing that a jury could base idea that it was all huge agitation and one. So basically, the defendant had an opportunity to change his mind, to not fire that second shot, elected to do so. By choosing to do that, he formed a separate intent. The victim was clearly moving, trying to get away. It was no longer a face-to-face confrontation. The situation had changed, and he was appropriately charged and convicted of two assaults and weapons to go with them. The court has any other questions?
Thank you.
Primary focus in their argument is, and they seem to be emphasizing it, is that there were separate acts here, and it's just they were separated just by time. And the state used one term in its argument. There were voluntary acts here, separate voluntary acts. Yes, there were two voluntary acts, but voluntariness does not equal intent. It's just there are two separate principles. You can have two voluntary says acts, but one intent under offenses as they're says defined. Now, one of the things I thought is in this case as I was sitting there, you know, essentially what I'm asking the court to do is affirm my client's convictions for assault, weapons offense, and a person prohibited offense for which the mandatory imprisonment is 6 years. Now, my client isn't happy about that. But essentially, we believe that under these facts, that's fair. That's mandatory sentencing. And that's one of the other, you know, factors that are involved here. As I sat there, I thought that if the argument that the state is making here that there are two acts and they're temporally separated and that's sufficient for two offenses, if their argument is in fact the law, I may have done a disservice to present clients and future clients, or because we have a lot of situations like this in the Superior Court where there are multiple shots, multiple punches, you know, multiple acts, multiple injuries in cases. But nonetheless, in those indictments, those are often charged as one offense. Here we happen to have, where we're arguing there was one offense, the state indicted says for two. We're arguing they're multiplicitous. They have two sets of mandatory offenses. That increases the leverage on the defendant. This defendant just went to trial here. But that begs the question as to whether there were, in fact, one offense here. So I hear complaints about mandatory sentencing. It ties the hands of judges and whatnot here. It's just that what I don't hear discussed sometimes, not just mandatory offenses, but there's a separate dynamic that the prosecution and the state can do that is against the theme of Brown versus Ohio and multiplicity, et cetera. They can compartmentalize offenses and increase the leverage on defendants. And thank you.
Thank you. Take the case under advisement.
Please rise.